Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning local news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state thanks to Utah Public Radio broadcasting out of Logan. Coming up on the show, Utah suspends its contract with a controversial surveillance company after its founder is revealed to have once been an active member of the Ku Klux Klan. Questions emerge about the Test Utah initiative after data shows a lower positive test rate than is seen in other labs. And Utah gets a refund for the $800,000 it spent on malaria drugs to treat COVID-19. And I have three guests joining me for the phone, for this conversation by phone today. Salt Lake Tribune, Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr is on the phone. And good morning and welcome to you, Thomas.
Good morning, Roger.
Thanks for being here. We've also got Salt Lake Tribune reporter Aaron Alberty. Welcome to you, Aaron.
Thank you. Hi.
Thanks for being here. And reporter Bethany Rogers, good morning and welcome to you, Bethany.
Good morning.
Good morning. We invite those of you listening to join as well with your questions and comments. You can call 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Well, for the first time, and I don't know how long, we're going to start today with something non-coronavirus, and that's probably because we don't have Thomas Burr, who is in Washington for the full hour of this show, but still, it's also because the story itself is worthy of top billing. Tommy, the company Banjo is a surveillance company, and we've talked about it on this show before because of what it claims to be able to do and the contracts that it has signed with multiple or municipal and state governments. I'm going to put us off the lead here for just a moment to ask you to remind us what this company actually does, Tommy. What it says it does.
Yeah, sure. Let's start with that because it is kind of it's already been a very interesting and I don't know, everyone is kind of a secretive situation going on to start with. So Banjo is this kind of Park City startup, and the idea that the company has is to take a whole bunch of information. They want to take 911 calls, look at social media, you know, track where police cars go, you know, whole bunch of data points that cities and counties, the state was going to give them, with the concept of it could, you know, kind of zero in, oh, there's an incident in this area because so many people were talking about it on social media and there's 911 calls coming here, and that maybe speed up responses and help police. That kind of surveillance, of course, had people a little nervous. To start with, the state had a sole source $750,000 contract, later became a $20.7 million contract with the state of Utah through the Attorney General's office. And again, the idea was taking all this information, giving it to a private company that was then going to turn back and try to help, first responders. And that's already, you know, come under fire because who is the state to give all this information to one private company? Yeah, there were questions raised already.
There's this Tribune article by reporter Leah Larson from March that describes the company this way. It listens to 911 calls throughout the state. It monitors traffic cameras, the location of police cars, your social media, and more. Again, Tommy, this is, you know, quote unquote, live time surveillance of the state of Utah. And as you said, that's rankled privacy advocates, as you would expect. All right. So Banjo relocated to Utah, to Park City, as you mentioned, a couple of years ago. It struck up a cozy relationship with the Attorney General's office. It signed these contracts that you were describing. This week, though, Tommy, a revelation about something lurking in the past of Banjo's founder. And I'll just let you tell that story.
Sure. It was a very interesting thing, and I'll tell you how it came about, apparently. So this news outlet called 10, it's part of Medium, Medium.com. I think some people are familiar with that. And it's kind of a tech newsletter news outlet. And it had dug into Damian Patton's past, which, you know, a lot of people have profiled this company and that, but it nobody had discovered these court documents because his name was apparently misspelled. As something different. This 10 was able to dig in and look at thousands of pages of, you know, court documents and testimony and grand jury testimony, and it found out that Damian Patton, who's the founder of this Banjo company, was at one point when he was a teenager part of the Dixie Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, and he at one point joined a leader of the KKK in a drive-by shooting of a synagogue. near Nashville, in a Nashville suburb. He had testified before, in court, that he admitted to participating in white supremacist talks and meetings. I'm quoting now from the 1-0 article, where, according to his own testimony, speakers advocated for the elimination of blacks and Jews, among other beliefs built around racism and religious discrimination. Hmm. So, pretty shocking revelation there.
Yeah, and okay, so one-time member of a racist organization, and participated even in a drive-by shooting of a synagogue when he was a teenager. All of that has the state of Utah obviously reevaluating its relationship with this company, or at least pressing pause. Can you talk about that part of the story, Tommy?
Sure. No, it was very quick, actually, action by the Attorney General's office. I saw this news report and reached out to the Attorney General's office, and I would say almost within minutes, a phone call is saying, we're getting you a statement, but just understand, we're going to put suspend this contract, and we're going to start an audit. And that's what the Attorney General's office did, and so did, I believe it was the University of Utah. I actually need to check that. But, it was a very, very quick action. We still saw this. And I don't think anyone wanted to, be involved with a company whose founder was once in the KKK. I should, give the part of Damian Patton's response, which is that, he admits to being part of that. He said he, fled home because of some problems at home. He was a homeless teenager. He was taken in by white supremacists who, kind of gave him a home, and he fell into that kind of trap, and that he's tried to make amends for it before and went into the Navy. And he said he's helped with prosecutions of hate groups like this before. And the company is now suspending all data collection and surveillance in the state. And it's actually says that the government should be the company working with the government should be subject to audits and oversight. So we're not sure exactly how this is going to take place, but the Attorney General's office wants an independent, kind of outside audit of how this contract came to be and what all they're doing. So a giant pause button has been hit.
Okay, and the founder, as you said, this is Damian Patton, who in his teen years, you said, got wrapped up in this and even participated in this drive-by shooting of a synagogue, which is bad stuff. He says that he's repentant and now is converted to trying to basically help prevent white supremacy from spreading. Is that the gist of it?
His statement he put out through the company was I'll just read part of it. Over the course of a few years, I did many things as part of those groups that I'm profoundly ashamed of and sorry about. And he later goes on to say, for all those I have hurt and that this revelation will hurt, I'm sorry. No apology will undo what I have done. And that was, the first thing. And then the company comes out the next day and says, okay, well, we're gonna cancel, we're gonna suspend all of our data stuff in the first place. Again, this was one of those things that everyone was already worried about. And then this on top of it just raised, many, many more red flags. And the Attorney General's office took action.
And again, these contracts entail allowing access to cameras all over the state. Traffic cameras, and then to use artificial intelligence.
911 calls.
Yeah, exactly. And it's AI, right? It's artificial intelligence that is trying to provide real-time data to police. A sort of laboratory, though, also, right? Isn't Utah kind of an experiment for this company? It's not really all that operational elsewhere around the country?
Yeah, exactly. And in Park City, for example, where this company is based, was given free access because they were part of the pilot project they were starting up, obviously the hope was that this company could take this forward nationwide. But there's several places that that did have contracts. I'm just looking real fast. I think Park City, Ogden. I think the University of Utah.
Right.
There's some that were trying it, and in the end, Utah has already been somewhat concerned about privacy for a long time for many reasons. One, given the state's political bent and a little more libertarian leanings, but also, there's that giant national security agency building, in the suburb between Sully County and Utah County,
right.
And that already had people a little on edge, and then the state's doing something with a private company that no one knows much about. It's a pretty secretive organization. This is not the last we're going to hear about this.
Do you know, we don't know what the state's going to do next. Is this the end of their relationship with this company, or we just don't know?
it hasn't canceled the contract. It's suspended it. So, you know, again, we could see maybe their audit comes back and says, you know, hey, somebody did something in their youth. They're, you know, they've repented for it. They're sorry. And that doesn't affect this. Or it could say that maybe there should have been more more reporting on a more checking into the company before we even actually jump to it.
Anything to add here, Tommy? If not, we'll move on to some more reporting from this past week's news.
No, I will say that I didn't plan to wake up this week and write about something in the KKK, but, you know, that happens sometimes.
That's the job of a reporter. Let's turn from thanks, Tommy, for your reporting on this, from a state contract on hold to another that has been kind of, I guess you could say, undone. And Bethany Rogers, will turn to you now for the latest on a story that we've been following for a number of weeks, the malaria drug coronavirus miracle that wasn't, at least as far as we know. In this instance, let's jump straight into the latest news. After a legal review, the state of Utah is getting a refund for its purchase of a bunch of pills. Maybe you can just lay that out for us, Bethany. Why is the state getting this refund, and how much is it?
The state in late March spent $800,000 for 20,000 packages of this anti-malaria medication that's been floated as a possible treatment for the coronavirus. And later has turned out to be much less promising than I think a lot of people would have hoped. And this last week, we learned that the state has received a full $800,000 refund for that amount. A couple of things kind of factored into the development, I think. One of them was that the Food and Drug Administration basically put out some guidance in recent days saying that these drugs shouldn't be broadly distributed. They should really be prescribed for coronavirus patients only within the context of a clinical trial or inside of a hospital where doctors can keep close watch over the people who are using it. So there was that. And then there was also officials just found that the supply chains were fine. These medications are used by rheumatoid arthritis and lupus patients as well, and other people with autoimmune conditions. And they were concerned about a run on the medication, and there would be a need for the state to have some kind of a stash of it. But they determined that that wasn't actually necessary, that the supply of the medication was fine, and that the state really didn't need to get involved after all.
The state had suspended basically any competitive bid process in this, you know, the emergency that we're living through in the global pandemic. And so one company in particular, Meds in Motion, got the contract to sell these pills, as you said, and now we've gotten the refund from that. Do we know, I mean, Meds in Motion was basically stockpiling the ingredients with the idea of having it on hand in a sort of, you know, be prepared and have a product on hand to sell. Can you talk about how Meds in Motion got this contract with the state of Utah, Bethany?
Yeah, we're still trying to figure out all of the details there. But Meds in Motion very early on was part of some of the Silicon Slopes work groups on testing and medication. There was one in particular that included NAMI Health CEO, who's been integral to launching Test Utah, along with some other entrepreneurs and companies, and Senate President Stuart Adams, and a couple of health officials from the Utah Department of Health were also engaged in those conversations. And it appears so far that some of those plans to sell the state the medication sort of formed within that group. Senate President Adams was very deeply involved in the talks and negotiations with Dan Richards of Meds in Motion, and kind of you know, just a proponent and supporter of exploring the drugs as a potential treatment for coronavirus. So it appears he made some connections with some state officials pretty early on in the pandemic, and that it kind of developed from there.
And then there was this internal review that was launched by the state of Utah. I mean, Governor Gary Herbert had said that he wasn't aware of, you know, of the fact that this first purchase of medication had happened. And then there were some questions about transparency. And so he launched a legal review. What did that legal review find, Bethany?
It found essentially that there might have been some problems or might have been some communication breakdowns along the way, but concluded that people were doing the best with the information that they had. It's a fast-moving situation in a pandemic. They're just trying to move quickly to adapt to an emergency situation, and that people basically had good intentions, that everyone acted in good faith. So they said while they're accepting a refund from Meds in Motion, you know, they thanked the company. They found that, you know, nobody acted in ill will. They even said as part of the review that they believe that the company was charging the state a fair price, which is something that has come under question in recent days. There's even been a price gouging complaint leveled against Meds in Motion as part of all of this. So the state, you know, kind of tried to tamp that down, saying that, no, this was a fair price. It's just that we didn't end up needing the medication. And they also released in their statement just some information about how the state has made a lot of emergency purchases during the pandemic. They've bought, I think, $70 million worth of supplies and services during the pandemic, and that they've had to return many of them because the vendors didn't deliver the products, failed, or the state decided it no longer needed them. So they were kind of suggesting that this wasn't really a unique situation in the middle of sort of an emergency response.
$70 million. It sounds like a lot of digging for some enterprising newspaper reporters to do. You know, you mentioned the price gouging complaint. This was levied by a group, Alliance for Better Utah, left-leaning group in Utah, that said that the price of the pills was higher than is seen elsewhere, and that was based on some reporting that that columnist Robert Gerke at the Salt Lake Tribune did. Can you? I mean, the state says that it wasn't price gouging. Are those numbers adding up? Basically, you know, can you look at the cost of the drugs and say actually this was quite a bit more, or can you say no, this was a normal price to be charging, Bethany?
So the pharmacists that I've talked to definitely say that the Meds in Motion deal was charging the state $40 per drug packet. The question, I think, is, well, how many pills is in each drug packet? The state has previously told us that it's 7. This last week, when I contacted them again about this, they were like, well, we're not sure. So the exact price per pill is a little bit unclear at this point, but regardless of that, you know, pharmacists and experts that I've talked to have said it does seem to be pretty pricey for this drug. The other complication is that this was compounded medication, which means that it wasn't pure chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine. It was mixed together with zinc, and it was also prepared in a different quantity than most of these malaria drugs are sold for. So it's a little bit hard to compare, but just for comparison, if it were 7 pills, it would be nearly I think it was like $5.70 per pill, which is well over the 25 cents per tablet that some people are able to get at stores, and also much more than the wholesale price for these drugs.
But a refund for the state from Meds in Motion and Utah House Democrats are asking for more reviews of what happened here. They issued a statement, or they wrote a letter in the Salt Lake Tribune, actually, saying that we still have some questions. What was the bidding process? Why was this particular company selected over others? We don't have answers to those questions yet, Bethany. Or you know, will we actually at some point have answers to those questions?
Well, it doesn't look like there was a bidding process, so I think we have an answer to that one. As to why this particular company was selected over others, I think that's still a little bit unclear. It's not really obvious, you know, whether the supply of these drugs in their more standard form was just unavailable out there on the market. I think officials at one point were worried about that and thought that Meds in Motion and this sort of unusual compounding deal that they had had sort of hatched with them was maybe the only way of getting access to these drugs. It's not entirely clear at this point, you know, why MedInMotion was the one. As I said earlier, the pharmacist seemed to have some relationship with, you know, some powerful state officials early on and got caught up in these conversations. And that might be as close to an answer as we get.
And so far, just we'll wrap this up and head to a break, Bethany, but, you know, we're waiting for some local studies to be conducted on the efficacy of this medicine. Some of them, as we've talked about in previous shows, haven't panned out, you know, haven't been shown to be all that effective in the fight against COVID-19. But there's the possibility that, you know, that it could be effective and then the state might have to consider buying some more again. That's speculation, but in terms of the study that's going on, are we still waiting for results on that?
We are, yeah. I think that those are the preliminary results I heard within the past week are a few weeks off. So I think that we should have some early findings soon. I know that the, you know, even in announcing the study, the researchers weren't, they kind of said straight out of the gate that this wasn't going to be a wonder drug, that they expected a kind of minimal effect or moderate effect is what they were hoping for, is like kind of the best case scenario, but they were expecting it really wouldn't show, turn out to have any real impact on coronavirus. So it's unclear, but that was kind of the expectations of the researchers going in.
Okay. Bethany, anything to add here before we head to a break, or have we talked this story to death?
I think we've hit pretty much all there is to hit.
Okay. Bethany Rogers is a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, and she's been covering the story of hydroxychloroquine for a number of weeks now. You can find her reporting at sltrib.com. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a minute. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Aaron Alberty and Bethany Rogers and Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also go, you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Well, because Thomas Burr is only here up until the next break, we're going to return to him and save Aaron Alberty's story on testing on the Test Utah initiative for just a moment longer. Tommy, we don't have reporter Courtney Tanner here with us today. I was going to rely on you to recount some of the stories that she collected from Utah medical staff who have been deployed to New York City, where more than 18,000 people have died from coronavirus. A team of medical staff have been in New York for 2 weeks. Courtney gathered some pretty remarkable tales from them. Do you want to choose one or two to highlight, Tommy?
Sure, and I'd actually, I don't think I could do this justice, so I'd also encourage your listeners to go to sltrip.com and find this story, because Courtney really just, it's really heart-wrenching stories, and it's talking about the, you know, 99 health workers, medical workers from Utah who went to New York, you know, the epicenter of the coronavirus in the United States right now. And really, you have to like drill down to like maybe in Utah, you're not really seeing the devastation that you are in New York City and the region around there, where these doctors were literally like, you know, talking about, you know, holding people's, you know, hands as they're possibly, you know, dying. There's one part where a physician from Utah, I'll get the name right, Dixie Harris, works for IHC. She's, you know, there with a patient that she knows is going to die, and she has to. She calls her husband because you recall, you know, family members are not allowed in these hospitals right now, so there people are dying alone. And I'll just read you this part. You know, her hands, Harris's hands shook as she dialed the phone. The man knew what she was calling to say, but didn't make it easier. When he picked up, the doctor was softly telling him, "Your wife isn't going to make it." It's one of those things. This is, you know, a guy in his 80s, both in their 80s, I think. She passed, but they had been together like 50 years. They'd celebrated most of their life together, and he's not even able to be there. But this doctor from, you know, far away from Utah is now in New York City having to tell them, you know, these really difficult stories. And they're positives, too, like the idea of, you know, a baby that was born and the mom being whisked away because, you know, they thought that, you know, she may die from COVID-19, and only to find out that she'd actually recovered and was able to be reunited with her baby after 12 days of being apart. And I think you want to highlight a couple, too, but it really shows you, you know, what's going on that we're not able to see ourselves.
I mean, yeah, to a person, I mean, for all of the medical staff who went there from Utah, it sounds like they knew about the severity of the situation, but they, you know, they had read about it, they had seen it on the news, but being there was something altogether different. And again, New York City is kind of the hotspot of coronavirus in the nation. One of the Intermountain doctors, this is from Intermountain Healthcare, who were deployed. This is an ER doctor who is with this group, is keeping an audio journal for KCPW, and it's been an interesting and personal view into what it's like on the front lines. And we're just going to play an excerpt of that journal now. This is Dr. RJ Bunnell for KCPW's COVID-19 Diaries. Take a quick listen.
After the initial thrill of deploying, my team and I are getting a little rough around the edges. We have nurses with bleeding noses from wearing a protective mask all day, hands that are red and raw from washing and sanitizer, sore feet and bleary eyes. Already we've been witness to deaths and tragic deteriorations at a rate that would have been unimaginable under normal circumstances. I had two patients today that are not in good shape at all. Both of them are in their mid-40s and take no medications. Both had coronavirus for 1 to 2 weeks before suddenly taking turns for the worse. My first patient today looked like two-thirds of his left lung was full of gunk that was keeping him from breathing well. He was needing about as much oxygen as we can give someone without putting a breathing tube down his throat. More ominously, he had some significant lab abnormalities that we see when people do poorly with this nasty virus. He looked pretty good when we were talking, and as we were wrapping up, he asked me how long he would be there. He needed to make a call and update his wife. I wish I could have given him a better answer. Truth is, I'll be checking my patient list for his name the rest of the time I'm here to make sure he's still alive. The last person I saw today had just been discharged to rehab about a week earlier. While his lungs were doing great, he had suddenly found himself experiencing severe, debilitating muscle spasms when he tried to move his arms or legs. His balance was off, giving him a sensation of being on a rolling ship, and he had trouble talking due to powerful facial twitching. COVID is showing itself to be diabolically creative. And it appears that this gentleman's own immune system is attacking the nerves in his spinal cord and brain. We got neurology involved as soon as possible, and it is possible that there are some therapies that will help. My best guess is that this really kind and scared guy, who is only 2 years older than me, is going to find himself significantly disabled for the rest of his life. Compared to other conditions, we have very limited experience with this new coronavirus. Despite claims to the contrary and some anecdotal evidence, a total of zero therapies besides oxygen are sure to help. The doctor who oriented me on my first day at LIJ was pacing the office today, the strain of weeks of watching many of his patients deteriorate and die clearly causing some angst. He correctly stated a few times that we just don't know what we're doing. He's absolutely right. For now, we'll keep trying new things and doing what we can to help.
And that's Dr. RJ Bunnell, who has been in New York with the crisis response team from Intermountain Healthcare. And that's just an excerpt of one of his entries. You can find more of them, and there are more to come at kcpw.org. But again, New York City has been incredibly, you know, it's been hit really hard. It has three times as many deaths as all of Germany, just for context, although Germany has had a pretty low number. And that's according to tracking done by the Johns Hopkins University. Thomas Burr, anything you want to add to the story before we head to, you know, more news, before we let you go, actually, and head to more news from this past week in terms of medical workers in New York City from Utah?
Yeah, I think it's very important to take a lesson from those, and that people should listen to that, and they should read these stories, and they should be paying attention. Look, I'm not a medical professional. I'm not an elected official. The state of Utah is opening up. I just saw something from Fox News about, a bar in downtown Salt Lake City was opening up last night at 12:01 a.m. There's a point of this that the disease does not care if you're Republican or Democrat, independent, and doesn't discriminate. So when you see these things of everything's going to get back to just completely normal, I would just urge people to pay attention when epicenters like this, when places like this are hard hit. It's devastating.
Okay. That's Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. And Tommy, I know we need to let you go, so we will do that and just say thanks very much for your reporting today.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Again, you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle here is at KCPW. We are going to move on to some other stories from this past week. And they're, of course, coronavirus related because that has been dominating the news. Aaron Alberti, thank you very much for waiting for the past 40 minutes. I want to turn now to a story that you reported on having to do with testutah.com. Let's first remind people what this initiative is, Aaron, and who's running it.
Okay, so testutah.com was an initiative that was announced in early April as a philanthropic effort by Utah's tech sector to increase access to testing and provide a screening tool for the state for possible patients as to whether they should be tested or not. And then they also said they were going to open testing sites in conjunction with Mountain Star, which runs Timpanogos Hospital, and Co-Diagnostics, a Salt Lake City biotech firm that developed a coronavirus test that they are using. Mm-hmm. So that's how it started, and yeah, that's what Test Utah is.
I mean, basically, one part of it, as you said, is an initiative that refers a person for testing if they meet certain criteria. Basically, it's a an app or a website, I guess. You put in your symptoms, and then it might send you off to get tested. And then the second part of that, as you said, is that they have their own testing facilities. And that's basically where the news from this week comes. There are some questions about the accuracy of the tests that that the testutah.com diagnostic labs are doing. Can you explain that, Aaron?
Yeah. So we received data from the state showing the test results for testutah.com. Now, Test Utah has, and we can talk more about this later, but they have been testing a number of asymptomatic people mm-hmm. who, of course, are less likely than symptomatic people to be carrying coronavirus.
Right.
So their data, their test results are reported to the state both by, by symptomatic people and by asymptomatic people. That's separated. And symptomatic people that they have tested, about 2% of those have come back positive. However, for the rest of the sites in the state, the rest of the test providers in the state, the rate has been about 5%.
Right.
So the rate of positives at the Test Utah sites has been less than half of what it is elsewhere in the state. That's a pretty big disparity.
Yeah.
So
I mean, maybe I don't know where to start because there's so many components to your story here, Aaron. There were some alarms that were raised by an expert at Intermountain Healthcare. The Tribune obtained some emails, and I don't know if this was in advance of that 2% versus 5% recognition that something was going on or not. But can you talk about the emails and what they said, Aaron?
Yeah, this came from an infectious disease specialist at Intermountain who sent an email to the chair of the task force on testing with the state, a health department employee, saying that he makes reference to the data being alarming. So this was written in mid-April, and this has been, and then I think that the discrepancy between Test Utah's positive rate and the rest of the state was even more significant. But he writes to the deputy director of the health department that he has concerns about the test product itself produced by Co-Diagnostics, and he has concerns about the lab that is processing results for testutah.com, which is the lab at Timpanogos Regional Hospital in Orem. Most of the rest of the state's tests are either being done by labs at Intermountain Healthcare, and I think the bulk of them are being done at ARUP laboratories up at the U,
right.
Which is, of course, a major national diagnostic lab.
So is there, I don't know. Is there some competition going on there? And is that, you know, potentially, let's go to this actually, Aaron. How do the folks at Test Utah explain the fact that they have this lower positive rate than the rest of the state?
Well, you know, they say that they are testing a different population. Obviously, they are testing asymptomatic people, but the disparity exists even if you filter out those results and only focus on symptomatic people. Mm-hmm. They say that, you know, their site is set up to accommodate even people that have just casual interest, that people with severe symptoms are more likely to have contact with healthcare providers just as a matter of care. And if somebody is really kind of on the fence as to whether, you know, they've got mild symptoms and do I have coronavirus, that they would be more likely to go to testutah.com where it's a bit, you know, more casual an interaction, whereas people with serious symptoms who are quite, you know, really worried that they have coronavirus are more likely to go to a healthcare provider.
Okay, so degrees.
Whether that account.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah, sorry, Aaron.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's degrees of symptoms is basically the they're, as you said, they're reporting symptomatic patients separate from those who are asymptomatic, meaning those who aren't exhibiting any symptoms, and that was still showed this lower rate. But their explanation is, well, they may be symptomatic, but it's just sort of milder symptoms. Is that basically it?
Yeah, that's sort of what they argued, and they've said that, you know, the lab that they're using is using FDA approved equipment. They've been trained to do the tests as any lab would be, and as to the test product itself. So the objections that the Intermountain specialist raised about the test itself.
Yeah.
Are that it basically, when they all got approval from the FDA to use these tests, all these different companies produced coronavirus tests, and there were a bunch of emergency use authorizations from the FDA. And in the documents with that and in the package inserts, they give data on how sensitive the test is in terms of basically what concentration of the virus do you need in your sample to trigger a positive result. Mm. And that number for the test that Test Utah is using is much higher than the test, for example, being used at Intermountain. Mm-hmm. Now, the ones being used at ARUP are, they're measured differently, so I can't compare that. Okay. But what Co-Diagnostics has said is, yeah, that limit of detection is what it's called, is higher for us, but it's still way below what actual coronavirus patient would be carrying in their sputum. Hmm. So even though comparing to some of these other tests, it seems like, you know, quite a bit less sensitive by that measure, that they're still well within what would be necessary to diagnose a patient. That's what they have said.
Weren't there some concerns, I mean, just in your reporting, Aaron, about the methods being used in the way that samples were collected for the Test Utah labs, basically how swabbing is happening, you know, how they're physically gathering, you know, a sample to test. Can you talk about that as well?
Yeah. Early on in this, at the Test Utah sites, which are staffed by Mountain Star employees, they were using throat swabs. And according to people involved with the Test Utah effort, that was okay according to the CDC at the time. But since then, the CDC has updated their recommendations saying, no, throat swabs aren't going to cut it. And so they started using nasal swabs instead. But, you know, so they've said during that time, it's possible that the throat swabs return fewer positive results and that they changed their practices in accordance with CDC guidance. Though I can say that we did speak to a patient that went to the test on April 13th, I believe. And I have the Test Utah results broken down by date, and they remain far below the rest of the state for quite a while after April 13th. It's only in the past 7 to 10 days that their numbers, the percent positives for symptomatic patients have started to rise to a little bit closer to what the rest of the state is getting.
This initiative, you know, the Test Utah initiative, and I don't know if it would have the same name, but it's gained traction in a couple of other states in the United States as well. Do you know if their tests, you know, if the tests that they're doing in these other states are seeing the same problems, or, you know, are those tests being processed here in Utah? Actually, that's another question.
So they have begun doing things at Iowa. So there's testiowa.com now and also Test Nebraska. The questionnaires on the website are the same as the ones in Utah, or at least they had been last time I checked. But in Iowa, they have begun doing this. Now, they haven't done nearly as many tests there as because they just started last week, but they won a $26 million contract in Iowa and $27 million, I think, in Nevada, or not Nevada, excuse me, Nebraska, to run these. And in Iowa, I don't know that they've had enough data. Now, I know that the head of their health department in Iowa said that they aren't separating out the data for testiowa.com, which is the same operation, the same business as the same vendors involved in testutah.com. But that data isn't being separated out, so I don't know how they would know whether the tests have the same rate of positives as other tests in Iowa. Those, as I understand it, from reporting out of Iowa by Iowa media, they have said that the state health lab, or the state hygienic lab is what it's called, there is their public health lab basically is going to be processing the tests from Test Utah, that they're not going to be processed at like Mount Timpanogos lab. Mm-hmm. And they've contracted for 540,000 tests there, so for over the course of the year.
Aaron, I mean, I guess, are the concerns ongoing about the test results from this company from the way that Test Utah is doing this, and are state officials still okay with people going to through this process to get tested? And then, I mean, because you wrote about a health department official who also raised some concerns here. I guess the question is the state on board? You know, okay with people continuing to go through the process of Test Utah's?
Oh,
Go ahead. Sorry.
So yeah, I'm sorry. When you talked about a public health official, I remember what you're talking about now. I'm sorry. The public health department said in emails to other task force people that we obtained, that they have been looking into the question of the different levels of positive rate, the different levels of positive testing that Test Utah is producing. Now, yesterday, during the daily coronavirus briefing, Governor Jerry Herbert said that they are confident in the Test Utah results and seemed, I guess, undeterred. In Iowa, I know the governor there has been asked about it, and she said that they are in the process of validating the tests. But, of course, they're using a different lab. So there are more, I guess, possible joints to in this process than simply the test itself. And that's what may be different between states.
And finally, can you talk about the, just because we do need to head to a break here, Aaron, and then come back for our underplayed stories, but can you talk about the price tag for this whole initiative? I mean, the state of Utah has contracted with Test Utah, you know, this isn't going through like insurance. It's going through the state of Utah to pay for it. Can you talk about what that price tag is?
Yeah, we have a $5 million contract with the state of Utah has a $5 million contract with Nomi Health, which is sort of acting as the general contractor in this. And that was inked out in early April for 2 months of testing.
Got it. Okay, well, Aaron Alberti, I'm sorry to maybe cut you a little bit short on this story, but
no, that's okay.
We do need to head to a break, and when we come back, we'll actually turn to a phone call and then do our underplayed stories of the week. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, back in just a minute.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Aaron Alberti and Bethany Rogers. This is our Friday morning news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Just before we head to our underplayed stories of the week, we're going to squeeze in one listener question. We have Sean from SLC on the line, from Salt Lake City, that is, on the line. And Sean, you've got a question for our panel. What's your question?
I have a question for you about the two stories concerning banjo and hydroxychloroquine purchasing. It seems like Utah state government has circumvented what I would imagine is normal government contracting processes. I mean, there were no oversight on the banjo, no bids, I don't think, for either. Data seemed clearly on the side of not purchasing hydroxychloroquine because there are side effects for it. Has anybody looked into what kind of relationships were developed to get around this process? Are these people hanging out at the gym together in the same political party? I mean, it seems unusual.
Sean, thanks for your question. I Bethany Rogers, I know that you can't address necessarily the banjo question because that's not something that you reported on, and Thomas Burr is no longer with us. But on the question of hydroxychloroquine and meds in motion, there you have reported that there is a relationship between Senate President Stuart Adams and the founder or the CEO of Meds in Motion, right?
Yeah, and I'm not sure if that relationship, you know, was like a personal friendship or anything that goes back, you know, any for any length of time. I know that, you know, like I mentioned earlier in the show, that they were in the same Silicon Slopes work group together. And I would also say that there are a lot of these no-bid contracts being awarded
right now.
Because the purchasing division has pretty much suspended typical procurement rules during the pandemic for coronavirus-related purchases in order so that, you know, agencies can act quickly and buy the things that they need. So there are potentially a lot of, you know, millions and millions of dollars of contracts that we can look at going forward and what we should look at going forward to examine how they were awarded.
And Sean, that's, you know, digging is being done. I think we kind of began to address that earlier in the show, but it's worth obviously looking into. Thank you very much for your call. And I'm sorry to have to cut you off because we are going to head now to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And Aaron Alberti, I'll start with you. What's your pick for underplayed story?
Brian Maffley has some coverage on the reopening of national parks. Bryce Canyon is set to reopen on May 6th with some restricted access to the park, like a lot of the trailheads and, you know, concessions and bathrooms and stuff are not going to be open yet. But they will get going, and, you know, there are some objections from the National Parks Conservation Association about the risk of coronavirus transmission still, but you can read about that.
Okay, check that out at sltrib.com. And I'm sorry that I just dropped Bethany Rogers from the line. So, Bethany, you don't get to give us your pick for underplayed story of the week. My apologies for doing that. Thanks for your pick, though, Aaron. I'm going to go with something that's not altogether underplayed, that today is the day that Utah moves from high to moderate coronavirus risk level. We did a full show on what that means, and you can find it over at kcpw.org or in your podcast feed. The show is In the Hive from KCPW. The same show features some young musicians, siblings from the same household, who are playing driveway concerts for people stuck at home right now. And it's some actual audio instead of phone audio that you can check out. Again, the show is In the Hive. It's at kcpw.org. As far as all of the stories we've been talking about on this show, you can find those at sltrib.com. Salt Lake Tribune reporter Erin Alberty, the last woman standing here on the line. Thanks very much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
That does it for this episode of Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Again, you can find podcasts at kcpw.org. Thanks to Operations Director Jesse Ellis and to the Utah Public Radio team in Logan for sending us out around the state. Thanks as well to Austin Booth for sound design on the audio journal from Dr. R.J. Bunnell that you heard earlier in the show. I'm Roger McDonough. Have a nice weekend, and thanks once more for listening.